Thank you. Thank you. Well, hopefully you all have had some very fruitful conversations. And it sounds like it as they continue. We also found that you all had some terrific questions for us as a panel. And we're going to take just a few minutes. There's not an ability to get through all of these questions, but some of our panelists are going to attempt to combine in a couple of cases and address some directly. And Julia, why don't we start with you? And I think you're going to try and address a couple of these questions.
Thank you, Sylvia. Yes, there's a set of excellent questions, but one specifically for the program I described in Mexico. Ask how has that program been evaluated and whether we actually know if it has had an impact on the behavior of the poor when it comes to health-related issues. And very quickly, I think this is a great question because it allows me to raise a larger issue, which is the need to evaluate, to build in systematic evaluation of these large-scale social interventions so that we actually know whether they're working or not. And both for the cash transfer program that Sylvia referred to, which has been a very successful cash transfer program, conditional cash transfer, bundled up with attendance to school, a nutritional package, and attendance to a clinic, and then the cash transfer is conditional on that. And also for the insurance program, we took advantage of the fact that the introduction of this program had to be gradual. So because it had, for financial and logistical reasons, to be gradual, it was possible to pair communities and then randomly allocate which communities would get the intervention first and which would come later. Everyone participated, but it was a question of the timing. And that opens a possibility of a very rigorous design where you can actually, in a very scientific manner, attribute whatever benefits you see to the intervention itself. I think we need to begin to think of evaluation not as an afterthought of some of these interventions, but as something that's built in. And very, very often, the design of the intervention itself lends itself to a rigorous evaluation. And this is important, A, because, for example, in the case of the cash transfer program, it was possible to measure, actually, even, gain in height and weight from children due to this conditional cash transfer and the nutritional supplementation. And then it was possible to argue with very solid evidence for resource allocation to expand the program nationally. But that knowledge also became a global public good, and now a large number of countries had adopted similar programs because it was so rigorously evaluated. So evaluation is not a luxury. It's a necessity, and it's actually a duty so that we actually know what's working or not. In the case of the insurance program, because we did a similar thing, I can tell you, and this has been published, that there are very significant improvements. First, a huge financial protection effect. So the amount of out-of-pocket payments from the poor actually dropped substantially in the relatively short period of time. This program, the law was passed in 2003, and it started in January 1st, 2004. It's expanded rapidly because in 4 years it's now covering 25 million people. And you do see a substantial drop in out-of-pocket payments in the number of families that are incurring catastrophic expenditures. But then you begin to see other consequences, like much higher utilization of preventive and early detection services. So, as I was saying before, in addition to the financial side of it, it also becomes a driver for inducing healthier behaviors and also for changing the whole way that the health system is run to be more responsive to what people need. Because of the logic of insurance, it is in the interest of the provider to stop people from getting sick. So because it's not a reimbursement insurance, providers are paid a capitated payment. So it is in their interest. So providers themselves begin to stimulate much more preventive behavior on the part of people. So the answer is yes, we have seen actual change. And the important thing is to always evaluate and build that into some of these innovations.
Thank you, Julio. And I'd forgotten to mention, Julio was the director of impact information and evaluation at the World Health Organization. So maybe the person that gave us that question knew that. So thank you. There definitely was measurement and change. James?
Thank you. I want to take the question that leads, what minimum central capital markets are required for local microfinance institutions to flourish? Sometimes it appears as if microfinance institutions is independent of financial systems. In an ideal market environment, it is important that microfinance be mainstreamed and become part of the financial system of the country. Under such circumstances, then it is important to try and have at least the minimum aspects that include one debt market, because ideally as microfinance institutions grow, even if they are taking savings, you find there are regulatory frameworks that restrict how much they can use savings in lending. If you look at the traditional regulatory frameworks, they take savings as matured deposits, and so you can't lend against savings on long-term. So you need long-term debt that is better, has two options. You can mobilize it from foreign loans, which then brings in a major risk of dealing with foreign currency risks. And most microfinance transactions are in local currency. So you're not able to hedge, and if you try to hedge, then the cost of hedging becomes difficult. So they provide a very good alternative in raising that debt. The other one is basically in terms of liquidity. When you have huge pools of savings and you're not able by law to let the whole of it, you want to participate in patches of things like government paper. But the best instruments are that which are tradable, such that as need arises, then you're able to liquidate them in the market. And lastly, the markets can be also very significant in, or capital markets are significant in building alternative assets. As the poor build their assets, they tend to diversify. They tend to move from most illiquid form of assets to fairly liquid assets as they move up, and markets would then tend to provide. And lastly, is as microfinance institutions become bigger and bigger, because of the gearing ratios that are imposed by regulatory frameworks, they find themselves building huge capital base. I look at equity, we have now a capital base of $450 million. We don't want to create such type of capital base when then the shareholders are tied permanently. There is liquidity. You want to create a form that shareholders would be able to keep on moving from the shares among themselves or to other parties. And then how do you also discover the true value of such an investment, again, if it is not in the market? So there is need to integrate the whole aspect of financial markets for the industry to fully flourish.
James, thank you. After those thoughtful comments on liquidity, you may be testifying before the U.S. Congress before you know it. And now, Abid, we will turn to you.
Right. Well, I have got a question here. It says, how can lessons of microcredit be applied to financing for small and medium enterprises? I'll try and explain this from my own experience. I run microfinance organization, and I also run a bank which is doing small and medium enterprises. And our bank in Bangladesh is probably the only bank which is doing small and medium enterprises in a big way. And this is because we have learned from microfinance as to how to finance small and medium enterprises. Now, when we started our bank to do small and medium enterprises, we decided that it's not going to be bank managers sitting in their own offices and small enterprise will come to them. We need to go to them ourselves. So basically, when we started with 5 branches in the year one, we started 300 small unit offices all over the country, and we had about 1,000 loan officers with motorcycles going around the countryside as well as small towns trying to find small businesses. So it's not the bankers sitting in their offices and small entrepreneurs is going to come, is you have to scout out and find out what the needs are in the small businesses. And then also, most of them lack collateral, and the banks mostly need collateral. So we basically went on for without collateral loan up to $15,000. So all we look at there for small enterprise lending is cash flows and the business and the individual who is borrowing. So basically, we are looking at the character of the individual, how long he has been in business, what kind of cash flow it has, and on that basis we provide loans. So that's the reason why this year we are going to disburse $600 million from our bank to small businesses. But then the medium businesses are slightly different in the sense that most of the medium businesses have probably borrowed from banks before, and they will have some collateral. But most banks don't want to touch them because it's too expensive in the sense that they want to lend money to corporate borrowers who need millions of dollars, and these people need maybe $100,000, $200,000. So you have to set up a small unit where they look at small enterprises, but all the due diligence that one has to do, it's more or less like corporate lending. So small enterprise lending is slightly different. Medium enterprise lending is slightly different from small enterprise lending. So small enterprise lending without collateral is very similar to microfinance, where you have to go out and find your clients and help them to get a loan and get business going. So that's one question. The other question was, microfinance is growing but not scaling at the rate needed. If you had a magic wand, what three things would you change to enable microfinance for all poor people globally? And I thought many of you know the answers. Some of you are involved in microfinance. But I thought one of the problems is finance. Not enough money is available. We are trying to raise $75 million. We are trying to raise this month. Hopefully we'll close it this month for Africa program, our expansion. It is very difficult to find funds at reasonable interest rate. Investors from developed countries look for very high returns from microfinance. I don't know where they got the idea that microfinance is extremely profitable, so you can get 20-30% interest rate. So I think a little bit less greed from the investors would be good. And we need to have much more resources for microfinance. So the poor people also need money at reasonable rates of interest, although they have been borrowing money at very high rates from money lenders, but that doesn't mean that microfinance institutions also need to lend money at money lender rate. It has to be reasonable so that one can get a surplus out of the enterprise that one is doing. The other thing that I thought would be interesting is I don't think we have got enough people trained to be able to do microfinance. So we need to really scale up training program for loan officers, microfinance managers, and so on. And we don't have enough of these people available in the world to really take microfinance globally all over the place. So I think that is something that we need to do. And the third thing is regulation. Could governments make things a little easier for us to try and get mobilized savings in some countries where it is possible? And many poor people want to save also. Savings is a service. But then because you don't have the license, and the problem with license is that when you're licensed as a bank, then of course you need to have a branch. Branch is very expensive. In one rural area, you don't need to have a branch. You need to have a small office with 5 loan officers. But if you need to have a branch, then of course it becomes very, very expensive. And also it becomes prohibitive or probably not very profitable. So in order to serve rural population for microfinance, you don't need branch offices. You probably need small microfinance outfits where you can provide loans and collect savings and use other banks for servicing your financial needs.
Thank you very much. And Jane, I'm going to welcome you back for themes and gems that have come from your all's conversations throughout all the tables and the half an hour you've spent together. Jane.
Thank you. What a wonderful panel. And you're going to get another chance to respond to the themes and gems. I've just found out what happens when the quality of the audience matches the quality of the panel, because these are really exceptional. They pick up on a lot of the themes in our earlier panel, our luncheon panel discussion. The first one speaks to both Fazal Abed's point and to Elizabeth Littlefield's point about regulation, that we should develop new regulations that allow microfinance institutions to be more flexible, especially to be able to accept savings deposits. The second speaks to standards, a point that Maria raised, and that is that we encourage cross-sectoral collaboration to decrease fraud in existing and developing financial services. The third takes us to food security, which is an issue that we have touched upon, and that is to develop financial instruments for improving livelihoods and agricultural productivity, especially irrigation and water availability. And then finally, one related to education that keeps coming up, and that is the need to increase financial literacy, especially among the extreme poor. Now, we also had some gems, so you get to respond to those themes to the extent that you haven't already. But here are just four gems. One is to strengthen the availability of financing for homes. Habitat for Humanity is going to like hearing this, in a way to help the poor build assets and pull people out of poverty long term. The second is to rethink delivery services, delivery systems for microfinance, systems including savings and financial education and literacy, and not just access to credit as our kind of initial core offering. The third is to develop innovative instruments for credit ratings for small entrepreneurs. And then finally, to develop a device that can serve as a phone cash payment device, a bank account. That's a whole panel that we're going to have on Friday, but let me give you a chance to respond.
Terrific. James, we'll start with you and go this way.
Thank you very much. Looking at the themes, PS is exactly what we had almost Abed had said. Regulation is really a critical thing that we all need to combine and address. And I think this is not an issue that individuals can take, because you'll be taking with your regulator, and there is a limit to which you can push your regulator. We need to come up together and have lobbying that would enable that to be. And of course, collaboration is the only way. Because this, as I say, if you look at the magnitude of the problem at the bottom of the pyramid, you look at Africa, for instance, it's only 4% of the population, sub-Saharan Africa, that has bank accounts. You're talking about 96% of the population is excluded. And they're excluded from a system that allocates resources. So once you exclude them from the system that allocates resources, you are really condemning them to poverty perpetually, and in a vicious circle. So let me make those comments, allow my colleagues to make a few comments. But I think those are the real themes.
Thank you, James. Julio?
I'd like to follow up specifically on the theme of cross-sectorial collaboration, because I think we need to start thinking of social and economic policy as two sides of the same coin, where the objective is to improve the livelihoods, particularly of the poor, and close social gaps. And we've tended to divide these two. There's a huge divide. I'm not an economist, but I am an economoid, because being a physician, I learned that I needed to speak the language of the Minister of Finance to convince him that good health policy was also good development and good economic policy. And if we look at these instruments, I mean, the paradox was we had this very successful cash transfer program, but poor people were spending their cash transfer to pay for the doctor and medicines because there was no health insurance. Or you build in microfinance the savings, and the savings were being depleted in the presence of one incident of health that was sufficiently serious to actually lead to that. Or you were starting microenterprises, but they would go broke because there was no... And we haven't talked about remittances, which obviously are going to be affected by the current financial climate here, but as a major source of financing in certainly I can tell you in my country, we found that about half of remittances were being used to pay for health care in the poorest communities which are receiving that. So those were monies that were being diverted from investments, for example, in homes, as one of the gems proposes, or were being diverted from investments in human capital through education of children. Because, I mean, just imagine what that is, a huge proportion just being used to pay for health care bills. So that's why I think that we need to build in this more comprehensive set of interventions. And as I say, once you have the platforms, once you've organized the communities around the microfinance entities, then you have already this platform where you can add on a number of services that really make that the total is much more than the sum of each individual part.
Strengthening livelihoods. Thank you, Julio. Abbott?
Well, cross-sector collaboration, I completely believe in that, in the sense that livelihood potentials for or improving livelihoods for poor people, just financial services doesn't do it. You have to work on agriculture, horticulture, fisheries, livestock, if they're rural people. You have to work on food processing and all kinds of things that you're involved in. So we have been trying to do all these things, trying to help microfinance clients to improve their income and livelihoods. So I completely agree with that there is cross-sectoral collaboration necessary. The other issue that Julio mentioned about health insurance, but there are societies in Africa and so on where health, even if you have health insurance, there's no doctor, there's no hospital, there's nothing going on. So what do you do with that? I mean, how can you do health insurance when there is whole system of health system doesn't exist? So I was going to say that what we do in BRAC is that every group that we have got about nearly 280,000 groups, and each of the group, we have got 70,000 health workers. Each of the group has nominated a person whom we train as health promoter, so that basic curative and preventive care is taken care of within the village, so that at least the basic health care is available within the village. Then if they require slightly higher level of care, then they are referred to a place in the district. So instead of just looking at trying to solve the problem in terms of insurance, in certain societies you need to probably create conditions in which poor people have access to some kind of care and basic care. So basic health services, primary health care, we want to make it available within the village itself if we can.
Thank you, Abed. And I'll only add on the questions of collaboration and regulation, I would just sort of talk about the idea of second-generation banking. You know, banking as we currently know it must change in order to meet the poor in terms of the distribution mechanisms that will be economically viable and approaches like the things that James talked about. So that's a part of it. And also technology and other services. There's going to be a whole other session on mobile phones and that sort of thing. And that was one of the questions we didn't have an opportunity to cover today. But this idea that there is a new approach and a new way to banking that will involve collaboration of whether it's banks and telecom institutions or commercial banks and microfinance institutions in order to do distribution. But this idea that there is a way to think about banking that's not the traditional bricks and mortar approach that we have, most of us in this room, have grown up with. The other comment I'll make is the point about agriculture and its importance. I think many of you know that at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we've done large investments in agriculture, increasing agriculture for the small holder farmer, that small farmer across the value chain. And this issue of credit availability is incredibly important, because when you think of the issue of a farmer, it's not just credit availability, but the example James used, when you actually have a crop coming in and you want to be able to get a better price than having to do everything right now. And so for a farmer and the increasing agricultural productivity, which is a base of many livelihoods in the poorest parts of the world, so that was a point I would like to highlight. It's a tough issue, though. It is the biggest thing for farmers is managing risk. That's the toughest thing that a farmer has to do, is manage risk in a way that can afford them the opportunity to take advantage of any opportunities they might have, whether it's new seeds, fertilizer, or anything else. So I think that was a very important point in our gems and our themes to highlight. Jane, before I turn it back over to you for our commitments, I just want to thank our panelists for terrific diversity and expertise in the space. It was a wonderful conversation. Appreciate all of your all's contributions. Thank you. And Jane, back to you for commitments.
I'm going to invite you to stay on stage so that you get to see these wonderful commitments, and invite Jonathan Reckford from Habitat for Humanity to come on up. Hi, Jonathan. How did you like that theme being put in there?
Delighted.
Just for you. Real quick, Habitat for, you all know Habitat for Humanity, and over a three-year period, they've had a housing finance innovation program, creating assets for the poor, and to mobilize investment capitals, or this is what they're projecting, to mobilize investment capital for housing microfinance to meet the growing need throughout the developing world, I mean, in every continent. They're going to be investing $8 million in housing microfinance and unlocking $13 million from other investors for capacity building. This commitment doesn't just support housing. It supports all that that goes with housing, that is to say water, sanitation, infrastructure, and technical assistance to 10,000 households. And it's going to include three regional workshops to help people make use of these opportunities. So let's have a great certificate for you, and a round of applause. We'll actually have it round side out. Thank you. Thank you so much. Habitat does such extraordinary work. Now I'm going to invite to the stage Deborah Holmes, who's Global Director of Corporate Responsibility at Ernst & Young, a wonderful company, and Premal Shah, who is President of Kiva. You all know Kiva as one of the great innovators in the microfinance space, so welcome to you both. Don't fall off, though. We can't lose you. You're too important to this. We refer to this as a but-for commitment. That is to say, it was a commitment developed as part of their CGI membership. Ernst & Young commits to partner with Kiva to facilitate the transparent flow of information and funds between individual lenders and microfinance institutions. Kiva is one of the world's first not-for-profit person-to-person micro-lending organizations. In this commitment, it will be serving even more entrepreneurs in the developing world. It's a $1 million commitment from Ernst & Young to initiate transparency procedures to strengthen the accountability of microfinance loans that are distributed by Kiva's network of partners. For Kiva, it's a three-year commitment to provide microfinance loans to 2.7 million entrepreneurs in the developing world. So please congratulate them both. How do I do two? Let's do two photographs.
Move away from the mic, I think.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you'll each get one of them. Thanks. And then finally, I would like Uli Frey, who's Executive Director of Fundas, to come up. Welcome. Good to see you. This is in collaboration with Mexico's Ministry of Economy. Fundas International commits to increase the income of 20,000 poor families in Latin America by enhancing performance and competitiveness of traditional retail stores. Now, this is what I mean by that, are mom-and-pop stores, which are so much the backbone of many economies. They do provide the jobs and the income for lower-income families throughout Latin America, and sometimes they are are threatened by the emergence of supermarkets and larger distributors and producers. So you're expanding on a successful pilot, as I understand it. Fundus International is committing to help smaller retail shops remain competitive in a global economy. And they'll be equipping them with modern business practices and finance and strategic management training. And so please join me in celebrating Fundus for their commitment.
Thank you so much.
So is this time is I'm sorry. It's time for Paul Rice then. This is the I'm sorry for doing that, but I just couldn't believe it was time for Paul. Paul is the CEO of Transfair. We all know Paul Rice, and Paul is coming up to share with us his progress report on an existing commitment. So Paul, please come on up.
Thank you, Jane. It's great to be here, and it's great to be a part of this stimulating conversation about the importance of access to capital for the task of sustainable livelihoods. Of course, those of us who have worked in the fields know that access to markets is just as important, and that is the core logic behind my work in the fair trade movement here in the United States. For those of you who don't know fair trade, in essence, fair trade is a rigorous standard for social and environmental sustainability. When farmers around the world step up and implement those practices, which include better wages, more sustainable agricultural practices, and so on, they get certified. And similarly, when companies here in the United States and in other parts of the world buy directly from those certified farmers, those companies are allowed to use the fair trade label on their products. So with that label, we're able to educate consumers and harness the power of consumer demand to the task of helping to lift farmers and communities out of poverty. It is that fair trade certified label and the growing demand for it which has spurred the explosive growth of fair trade here in the United States. In Europe, fair trade has been around for 30 years. In the United States, as usual, we're a little slow to catch on. In the last 9 years since the fair trade label was introduced, we've seen over 700 major brands join the fair trade movement and offer fair trade products. 1.5 million farmers now around the world in Africa, Asia, and Latin America are participating. They're growing coffee and tea. In fact, there's fair trade coffee from Rwanda being served on the first floor. These farmers are growing bananas and sugar and a whole host of products. And it is the success of those products, not only from a moral and ethical perspective, if you will, but also from a business perspective for the retailers and for the brands, which is driving growth and driving the expansion of the category. Fair trade sales last year in the United States were over $1 billion. So I think the skeptics at the beginning of this journey have been proven wrong. And clearly, American shoppers do care about where their products come from and want to make a difference. So our commitment last year here at CGI was to launch Fair Trade Flours. Most of us here in the United States may not be aware. Most of the flours that come to us here in the United States are imported. They come from Colombia, they come from Ecuador, and Kenya. And the conditions on those farms are typically quite hard for the workers. Average wages in the Colombian flour sector are $3 a day, maybe $4. These are products that use a lot of agrochemicals, and exposure to agrochemicals is one of the chief problems for the workforce, which, by the way, is 90% women. So environmental degradation, worker safety and health, wages, these are the issues that the Fair Trade Standard addresses. So what did we do? We went out and developed a standard for fair trade flours. Then we went out and certified 8 farms as part of this pilot in Ecuador, in Colombia, and in Kenya. These farms employ about 10,000 women. And then we went out and found a market for the product. And we were able to get 10 companies here in the United States, including Whole Foods Markets and 1-800-Flowers and Sam's Club and leading retailers to step up and join us in this pilot to see if we could put fair trade flours on the map, to see if it would fly. So we launched on Valentine's Day, which is a great day to launch flours. And I'm happy to report that in the 6 months since the launch, we've certified over 2.5 million stems of fair trade roses here in the United States.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that volume represents a significant income increase. The workers on those farms are now making 20% more than they were making before, and that is the current wage rate in the surrounding areas. They are also getting premiums which allow them to invest in community development projects. And this is a hallmark of the fair trade model. An above market price which allows these communities to build their own schools, to build their own clinics. And I happened to visit a number of these farms a few weeks ago in Ecuador, and already we're seeing the impact of this additional revenue. One of the farms had built a daycare center on the farm, accessible to everyone who works on that farm. Another farm, the workers on that farm had set up a home loan program so that they could provide small loans to help build their homes to all of the workers there. Another farm had supported the local clinic by providing permanent healthcare staff in that clinic. So very concrete examples of small but important steps forward in terms of livelihood and well-being on these farms. And thanks to nobody's charity. At the end of the day, thanks to a very simple concept of a fair price for a great product. So I'm happy to say that the Clinton Global Initiative was, in my mind, very much a part of the success, because we took the fact that we announced this commitment, that we made this commitment last year in the context of CGI, we took that to the retailers and we said, we want you to be a part of this partnership and this commitment. And that was a very compelling a pitch. And these companies are finding that fair trade is working, for fair trade flowers is working in terms of not only sourcing more sustainably and more ethically, but also in terms of their business. Before I step down, I've been invited to share with you that after 9 years of focusing on certifying only fair trade food products, our commitment here at CGI this year is within the next 12 months to expand the category and adapt the fair trade model to the apparel industry. We will be certifying fair trade garments in 2009. Thank you.
So, on that note, let's throw some bouquets to Sylvia, to Ave, to Julio, and to the missing James Mwangi and Bob Rubin.
James left to make a commitment in another CGI event.
That's right. James is on to another panel, and we look forward to seeing you at the plenary. So thank you so much.
We would like the table facilitators